to Shattering Myths. I'm your host and tour guide, Yada. Each weekday morning on GCN, I strive to expose the beguiling and destructive myths associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, even with the military and economic schemes. If you listen, your eyes may be opened, and you may ultimately change your mind towards some of these human institutions. Instead of merely presenting the news, my mission will be to help you understand what is occurring behind the headlines, all while predicting how these events will shape our world. Then during our second hour, we're going to engage Yahweh on his terms by way of his one and only covenant and through his always dependable Torah teaching. So with his guidance, you will be able to replace your religion with reason and engage in an actual relationship with God. The first story this morning is one that I had sent to me. It tells us that a scrap of papyrus makes an explicit reference to Jesus having a wife, according to a renowned expert in Christian history. Well, if you were a renowned expert in Christian history, the first thing you would know is there is no historic legitimacy to the name Jesus. In fact, the first use of the J wasn't until the 17th century.
Well, it would be the same as being a renowned Norse gods.
Yeah. The us ending of the name is a derivative of Greek grammar rules. There is no correlation whatsoever between the name Jesus and Yahusha.
I feel like this guy has read too many Dan Brown books.
I think, indeed, he has. A Harvard Divinity professor, which is to say someone who knows a lot but understands nothing, Karen King unveiled a 4th century Coptic script at a conference in Rome. 4th century. 4th century. Let that sink in. A 4th century. In the 4th century, Constantine created the Roman Catholic Church. Any reference to the words and deeds of Yahusha that are written past the 4th century, in the 4th century, and past the 4th century, are stunningly corrupt. When you're studying the oldest manuscripts of the so-called Christian New Testament, what you come to recognize is that there are 69 pre-Constantine manuscripts. 69. Constantine came to power in 325 CE. And from that point on, the fidelity of the accuracy, the consistency in the manuscripts changes so radically that anything after Constantine came to power, you know you cannot trust. So any document from the 4th century is grotesquely unreliable. And that the difference between the text of the earliest 69 manuscripts and what is now used as the basis of the translations in English Bibles of the so-called Christian New Testament is there's a variance of over 300,000 words in a text that is only 182,000 words long. That's how many variables there are. And the discrepancy, the lack of veracity of any document from the 4th century is just about zip.
This actually raises a question for me. Yahusha, I'm sorry, when he was here, he was the living embodiment of the Torah. And does it ever explain in the Torah? And you don't have to like give me the answer. You can just tell me where to look, and I can find this out on my own. Does it ever explain why he doesn't take a wife or anything like that? Because that would be part of the covenant, wouldn't it? I mean, he was pretty.
Yeah, there would be. He is presented in the covenant as the covenant is. Mm-hmm. How is the covenant? Mother, father, child. And so God presents himself to us the same way that he presents his covenant. The covenant is a family where mother and father, our heavenly father, spiritual mother, which is a set apart spirit, conceive a child to make a family. You become a family with the child. So okay. The Yahusha is presented as the child, not as the father. And so as the father, he would not need a mother. And so the reason that he is not married is he concludes the concept of the covenant of father, mother, and child living together in harmony in a family. And so he is presented as the son, never as the father, because if he were married and had children, then he would be the father. Okay. And he's not. He is a set apart manifestation of the father as the son. So Karen, as a student of Christian history, would know for a fact that any manuscript that dates after and includes the 4th century is not reliable. And yet she still purports this manuscript to be valuable, to be reliable. In it, she claims that the researchers have identified the words, Jesus said to them, my wife. Well, there is no Jesus in any 4th century manuscript. There wasn't even a J to communicate that concept. And in every manuscript prior to 350 CE, 100% of the time when Yahusha's name was written, it was not written out. It was a divine placeholder was used instead of writing his name. And the reason for that is truly that the Greek did not have the letters to properly transliterate his name. Not only was the Greek alphabet incapable of correctly transliterating, which means to replicate the sound of Yahusha's name using the characters of that alphabet, the authors of the eyewitness accounts wanted readers to turn to the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, to the Hebrew, to understand not only the proper pronunciation of the name, but the meaning of the name. Yahusha means Yahweh saves. It is an extraordinarily important concept. So in a early 4th century manuscript, anything written prior to 350 CE, the name Yahusha wouldn't even have been written out. And most certainly there was no name written Jesus. So the Harvard Divinity professor is lying. Now she says that Jesus said to them, my wife, which might refer to Mary Magdalene. Christian tradition holds that Jesus did not marry, but Mrs. King said in early years it was subject to debate. That's not true.
What? You mean the Da Vinci Code isn't true?
It's not true. It's a work of fiction. That's why you'll find it in the fiction aisle. The provocative find could spark debate over celibacy and the role of women within Christianity, she said. Well, I tell you what. If a 4th century document, which she has lied in terms of even the representation of, sparks debate, then we will be debating nonsense. But the announcement sparked skepticism from some theologians. Jim West, a professor and Baptist pastor in Tennessee, said, quote, a statement on a papyrus fragment isn't proof of anything. It's nothing more than a statement in the air without substantial context. Well, that's also true. The name Yahusha was actually a very popular name in throughout that region at that time. It is the same name that Yahusha, the son of Nun, who was the successor to Moshe, had, and there has always been the tendency of Hebrews, of Jews, to use the scriptural names of the past. And therefore, it would not be uncommon for them to have been many Yahushas, many of whom, most of whom, had a wife. And so that's about all you've got there. And as a matter of fact, if the name was actually written out as Yahusha, then you would know that it was not a reference to the Yahusha, the son of Yahweh, because his name would not have been written out in the 4th century.
Would have been a place marker, right?
Correct.
I was just going to ask about that.
Yep. It would have been a place marker, a placeholder. Wolf Peter Funk, a noted Coptic linguist attending the same conference as Mrs. King, the professor, the nincompoop, I should say, from Harvard, said that there were thousands of scraps of papyrus where you find crazy things, and many questions remained about this particular fragment. Thousands, millions of fragments exist throughout the sands of Egypt. Ms. King said the document written in ancient Egyptian Coptic is the first known scripture which states that Jesus purported to have a wife. Well, now we've got strike three on this. All of the eyewitness accounts were written in either Hebrew initially, as is the case with Matanya's eyewitness account, or they were written in Greek. If something is written in Egyptian Coptic, it was not authored by any of the disciples or any of those like Mark and Luke who used hearsay evidence from the disciples. Coptic was not a language that anyone associated with Yahusha spoke. Yahusha did not speak Coptic. If there's something written in Coptic about a Yahusha, it is something that was conceived by someone who was 400 years removed from the actual events. Now, she said that the 4th century text was a copy of a gospel probably written in Greek in the 2nd century. And how would she know that? First of all, the term gospel was not conceived until the Middle Ages. We only have two eyewitness accounts, that of Yahochanan and that of Matanya.
Well, she's definitely taking a lot of liberties with what one piece of paper is.
I mean, because it makes her career if she can prove that that she has stumbled on something that upends the religion that she claims that she is a student of.
That's where you're wrong. She doesn't have to prove it. She just has to make people believe her.
That's right. That is correct. And that's what she's playing on, people's faith here. There is no logical connection of any kind here. And the fact that she is speculating that this was a text from a gospel, when there was only two eyewitness accounts, we have 69 manuscripts that have been unearthed from the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd centuries. Not a single manuscript has been unearthed from that period of time that speaks of any other eyewitness account. She's lying.
Making the...
Shattering this, I am your host, Yada. We're exposing an idiot that has a PhD and teaches at Harvard. No wonder Harvard graduates such nincompoops. She said that her 4th century manuscript was a text, was a copy of a gospel probably written in Greek in the 2nd century CE. Now, of course, she can't prove that. In fact, all the evidence says that she's lying. Only were two eyewitness accounts that are witnessed to have been written in the 4th century and are and find proof of their writing in the 2nd century. That is Yahochanan's eyewitness account and that written by Matanyah, which means Yah's gift. Yahochanan means Yah was merciful. There are two hearsay accounts, one by Marcus, the other by Lucas. Marcus and Lucas, neither were eyewitnesses, so their testimony is hearsay. Both of their accounts are attestable prior to the 3rd century. One of them was had access to some of the disciples and therefore has tried to piece together the story the best he could from hearsay. And the same thing is true with Marcus. Marcus was Shimon Kephish's, who we know as Peter's, translator. Luke was assigned most of his life to Shaul, Paul, and later in his life realized that Paul was a false prophet. So there is absolute historical evidence that there was not a spurious gospel from which this could have been written in Greek in the 2nd century and then later translated into Coptic. We know what was available in the second century, and her gospel was not among them. All of the spurious gospels that you hear about, they're mostly Gnostic in their traditions. Almost all of them came into being in the fourth century, at the time of this writing, when people were trying to conceive the and to make, to craft, to build a Christian God in the image of man. She said she was initially skeptical about the yellowish-brown papyrus and started from the notion that it was a forgery, but she quickly decided that it was genuine. Why? Because it serves her career. Several other experts agreed, she said, but the final judgment on the fragment depends on further examination by colleagues and further testing, especially in the chemical composition of the ink. What they're going to prove that her new conclusion is right, that it was written in Coptic in Egypt 400 years from the time the events took place, and that therefore by being written in a language that wasn't spoken, Coptic, in fact Greek wasn't even spoken by Yahusha or his disciples, that translation two times over from a non-existent, non-extant text, 400 years distant, is somehow genuine and credible? Okay, if you believe that, then you would be you would get an A in your class in theology at Harvard. Mrs. King said that the script was not proof of Jesus' marital status. Well, since there was no Jesus in the first century, that would be a true statement. It is not proof. It is not evidence for us historically that Jesus had a wife, she said. Well, that's also true. It is not evidence of history that he had a wife. It's quite clear evidence, in fact, that some Christians, probably in the second half of the second century, thought he had a wife. Well, that's not even true either, because her document is written in the fourth century. So all it is proof that in the fourth century, should it be dated to the fourth century, that someone, whatever the Coptic variation of Yahusha is, that this person that is the Coptic transliteration of Yahusha, that somebody thought that individual had a wife in the fourth century, and that's all it means. Mrs. King said it reveals concerns of the early Christians with regards to family and marriage matters. From the very beginning, Christians disagreed about whether it was better or not to marry, but over the centuries after Jesus' death, I know the Christian God dies, he not only is misnamed, but he dies, and man kills him, which is kind of interesting, they began appealing to Jesus' marital status to support their positions. Actually, the position on celibacy is all about Paul, the false prophet. He wants everyone to be celibate as was he, or at least as he alleged to be. So this shows that there were early Christians for whom sexual union in marriage could be an imitation of God's creativity, and that it would be spiritually proper and appropriate to be married, so says our theologian from Harvard. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths.
Gardeners.
Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. This news story comes to us by way of CNN. The dateline is Cairo. It's an interesting review of events that have transpired since the Muslim Brotherhood came to power in Egypt. It reads, "There are some in Egypt who seem hell-bent on repudiating, indeed destroying, the link between Egypt's distant past and its messy present." Morgan al-Ghorhari, a jihadi sheikh with a history of radicalism appeared on the private Egyptian TV channel, Dream TV 2, Saturday evening, and declared that if he and his ilk came to power, they would not hesitate to destroy the Sphinx and the pyramids. By the way, it was Egyptian TV 2 that mistranslated and aired the Innocence of Muslim trailer to incite riots and hatred towards America. They are under the control of the Muslim Brotherhood. So the fact that they had a jihadi sheikh on their channel speaks not of of his radicalism, but him being a fundamentalist Muslim, him being a Salaf Muslim. Salaf means that he adheres to the Islam that was practiced by Muhammad. And, of course, what he wants to do is to destroy the Sphinx and the pyramids. Now, he is no stranger, this article says, to the notion of vandalizing ancient artifacts, boasting to the show's host, Al-Abrashi, that while in Afghanistan, he took part, along with the Taliban, in the demolition of the Bamiyan Buddhas in March of 2001. His threat was met by Al-Abrashi and other two guests who were in shock, and he said, just to be clear, the host of the program asked the question three times. The host said, I am going to wake up tomorrow to find that, just as you did with the statue of Buddha, that you have demolished the Sphinx and the pyramid. The jihadist Muslim said, that is dependent upon abilities and possibility. According to our Sharia, in other words, Islamic law, every pagan idol must be destroyed. Now, that's true. The Sphinx is a pagan idol. And the pyramids are tombs to men who claimed to be God, and they're covered with pagan inscriptions. They're not going to survive Yahusha's return. The Buddha statues, they're not going to survive Yahusha's return. God doesn't want us to be exonerating pagan deities. Now, the fact that now no one worships the Sphinx and no one worships the pharaohs and no one, well, at least that I know of, worships the Buddhas in Afghanistan means that they're now just really an archaeological history, means that they're probably exempt from Yah's instructions to destroy them because no one is beguiled by them anymore. But they were once beguiling. That part is true. Anyway, the host said, if you're in power, you'll destroy the Sphinx and the pyramids and all of the pharaoh statues and the pharaoh's artifacts. Now, the problem in doing this is that in today's world, it is beneficial for us to know the history of religion, the history of politics, the history of militarism. And when we come to study the history of these things, of man's institutions, born and bred in Babylon and exported from Babylon to Egypt and Egypt to Greece and Greece to Rome and to other places in the world and now embedded in the religions Roman Catholicism, it is helpful to us to know these things because then we can understand why God tells us that he wants us to walk away from them. And the more we understand them, the more we can appreciate how they have corrupted lives over the past. But anyway, he says, yes, if I'm in power, I will destroy the Sphinx and the pyramids and all of these artifacts. He said everything because it's a pagan statue or idol that is worshipped or suspected to be worshipped or is worshipped by one person on earth, it must be destroyed, or we must destroy it. Now, the fact is that Muhammad's religion was based upon the worship of the black stone in the Kaaba, a stone god. And so the Kaaba itself is a shrine to pagan gods. There were 360 rocks that represented gods and goddesses in the rock garden that was the Kaaba. And so the Kaaba is actually worse than the pyramid and the pyramids in that for much of the time that the pyramids were built, God was considered Amen-Ra. And so at least there was some dignity to God as opposed to him being the black stone. I mean, not that adding dignity to a false god is a good thing, But the fact of the matter is, Islam itself is based entirely on the pagan past of Arabs. Almost every, in fact, every one of the five pillars of Islam has a pagan ancestry. And so, if you were going to destroy objects of worship that are illicit and a pagan past, the first thing you'd have to destroy is Islam. Because Islam is poisonous today because there's 1.5 billion people who are beguiled into worshiping Satan as if he were God as a result of Islam. There is nobody on the planet today that's out worshiping the Sphinx or the pyramid thinking that it is a divine statue. Now, of course, the issue in Egypt is what little economy Egypt has is based entirely on what was done in Egypt prior to the Muslims conquering the place. Once Muslims conquered Egypt, there was nothing more to build, nothing more that anyone in the world would want to see. They destroyed, they did not build. And so the only hope for the Egyptian economy is to leave these artifacts. But he said, yes, I will destroy the Sphinx and the format and the pyramids. This particular article goes on to say that that speaks of the Egyptian revolution, which was born in rapture and enthusiasm, and it now resembles a Pandora's box. It's not a Pandora's box. There's only one thing that the Egyptian revolution wrought, and that's the reformation of fundamentalist Islam. The Salaf Muslims and the Muslim Brotherhood won 70% of the seats. They, by themselves, without interference from anyone, created the Constitution of Egypt based upon Sharia law. Egypt has gone from a secular state to a sectarian one. It is now fundamentalist Islamic, and the people brought this upon themselves. Hope never sprang forth, and extremism didn't either, even though that's what this article reads. It is now simply Islam. There is nothing but crime, disorder, and fear, which is what the author has recognized has emerged. And no one has come up with a way to put them all back into that box. We open the box that was conceived by Muhammad. We open the box that was inspired by Satan, and now it has unleashed its hell upon the Egyptian people. In the days of Hosni Mubarak, this article says, everyone knew the extremists lurked on the dark outer fringes of Egyptian society. No, they didn't. They lurked within its heart, its primary university, Al-Azhar University, that the Muslim Brotherhood was the single most popular institution in Egypt. It was part of its heart. It was not on its outer fringes. It did not keep a low profile. It wasn't just behind bars or holed up in Afghanistan or Pakistan. No. Everyone that knew anything about Islam and its march towards fundamentalism over these past 40 or 50 years recognized that given the people the right to vote for the government that they would choose, that 70% of them would choose the most fundamentalist Muslims to represent them. And that's precisely what they did. In the New Egypt, they've come out of their cells and back from exile to rant on national television and to make inflammatory speeches. Egyptians have heard all of this before, that the pyramids and the Sphinx are pagan monuments to and idols and therefore must be destroyed. There was a widespread rumor last year that a Salafi, this is in parentheses now, ultra-conservative Muslim, yes, that's what Salafi means. It means that they adhere to the words and deeds of Muhammad, that he was advocating covering the monuments in wax, but that proved to be spurious. It's no secret, however, that the, he says, extremists, and he meant to say Islamists, the fundamentalists, here don't like what these ancient monuments represent. Proof that magnificent human achievement is not the monopoly of one religion or race. Think of that. What they're saying here is that there is a there is magnificent human achievement in all religions and all races, and that it's not the monopoly of one religion or one race. Well, there were multiple religions in Egypt, and Egypt was not Arab when it was Egypt, and there is no magnificent human achievement that can be attributed to any Islamic nation. Never. What the monuments actually show is that before Muslims infested Egypt, conquering it, that there was great building in Egypt, that an empire could be created, that great monuments could be created by the Egyptian people. But once the Muslims poisoned Egypt, there has been nothing of value that has been created there. Tourists to Egypt do not come to see anything that has transpired since the Muslims took over that country following the death of Muhammad. They come to see what was built before them. This Islamic fundamentalist, this jihadist sheikh, Al-Ghahari, is not the first one to call for the destruction of Egypt's ancient landmarks. Back in 1378, an equally zealous Muslim mystic took offense at the Sphinx and looked upon himself to try to demolish it. There are several versions of what happened next. Some stories say a flash flood ensued and the villagers, fearing a pharaoh curse, pharaonic curse, promptly lynched him. Other accounts say that he was charged with vandalism and subsequently dismissed. One of the things that is a myth is that Muslims, when they conquered lands like Egypt, preserved the ancient documents that the Christians before them had destroyed. Now, it's true that there is some evidence of Christian vandalism. I'm not a proponent of Christianity, and of them destroying some ancient documents. But the worst of the fires that vandalized, for example, the Library of Alexandria, were perpetrated by Muslims. And there is very little evidence of Muslims preserving much of anything, and certainly no evidence of them promoting anything of value. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Segment of the News Hour of Shattering Myths. A senior military figure in Lebanese Shia Islam has died. This report is that a Hezbollah militant has been killed, and he has been killed engaged in Mujahideen activities. As a matter of fact, his death was pronounced as that of a martyr, which means that he was killed while killing on behalf of Allah and Islam. Now, the reason that this report is interesting is that heretofore there has been no evidence that Hezbollah has engaged. The control mechanism that Iran has of the Syrian dictator Assad is through Hezbollah, which is headquartered in Syria. Nasrallah lives in Damascus, Syria. He is the head of Hezbollah. Hezbollah directly reports, as does Nasrallah, to the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. It is interesting that Hezbollah has not engaged. What you have in this war is a group of Sunni Mujahideen jihadi groups that are armed through the United States, through Qatar, through Saudi Arabia, and through Iraq. Sunnis in Iraq, not the government of Iraq, but Sunnis in Iraq, have weaponized what was a peaceful revolution against the Assad government, which is Alawite and therefore Shia. But all through this, Nasrallah has advised Hezbollah not to engage. He wants to use Hezbollah's weapons to kill Jews against Israel, not against Sunni Muslims in Syria. And so for a Hezbollah militant to die in a jihadi operation means that Hezbollah is now concerned that without their support of Assad, the regime may fall because of the weapons that have been supplied to the Sunni militants. Now, if Hezbollah does engage in a massive way, the carnage that we're witnessing in Syria will escalate to the point where rather than tens of thousands of people dying, we'll have hundreds of thousands of people dying. Now, Hezbollah said that Ali Hussein Nashif was buried in the Bekaa Valley on Monday, and he had been killed, quote, performing his jihadist duty. Rebels said that Nashif had and several of his men had been killed in an ambush by the Free Syrian Army. Now, Free Syrian Army is comprised of Mujahideen who have surrendered to Islam and want everyone else in Syria to surrender to their interpretation of Sunni Islam. There's no freedom associated with them. Other reports said that they had died in clashes on the border. There's been no confirmation that he was Hezbollah's commander in Syria. The U.S. has accused Hezbollah of providing training, advice, and extensive logistical support to the Syrian government, an allegation the group has denied. Well, the fact of the matter is that Hezbollah, as the arm of Iran in Syria, is providing training, advice, and logistical support in addition to weapons to the Syrian government. But it would prefer to deploy its militants against Jews, of which there are bonus jihad points for killing Jews in Islam as opposed to killing a fellow Muslim. Although the Quran endorses killing a former Muslim if that Muslim is not a jihadist. The only thing that you can't do in Islam is kill a fellow jihadist.
Wow, it's a heck of an internal struggle there. I mean, isn't that what they say that jihad actually means? Isn't that what they try and tell us?
Oh, yeah.
Even though I
yeah, he was
IQ.
Guy was killing, was killed performing his jihadist duty. So how would you get killed performing your jihadist duty if jihad is an internal struggle to resolve internal conflicts?
Yes. Some people have a tougher jihad than others, apparently.
Yeah, I guess. This fellow's jihad caused him to be killed because he was wielding weapons, and he was killed for having wielded his weapons on people whose weapons, jihadists whose weapons, were more capable than his. The Lebanese officials also believe members of Hezbollah's military wing, the Islamic Resistance, to say that Hezbollah has a military wing is like saying that the Marines have a military wing, are fighting in the Syrian conflict, citing as evidence a number of quiet burials of martyrs in the Hezbollah-dominated areas. Now, when we return to Shattering Myths, we're going to continue this story about Hezbollah in Islam. Oh, as I understand, this is actually our final segment. And so we'll have to part and resume our discussion of Hezbollah on another day.
There's a guy named Dr. Wallach who is anything but your typical doctor, both a veterinarian and a naturopathic physician. Doc asks, why is this country spending more money on healthcare by far and rank?